Have you ever wanted to learn a new language, but just didn't have the time or money? I may have a solution for you. Her name is Jessica, and she gives free Chinese lessons daily at 11 p.m. Beijing time and 11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. Chinese is fun and easy if you have the right teacher. Let Jessica be that teacher and introduce yourself to the fastest growing language in the international job market today at tinyurl.com/tcjessica and tell her Ian sent you.
Do you like fine art but think it might be out of your price range? Do you have a vision for a painting that you'd like to see brought to life but you just don't have the skill? I might have a solution for you. Art by Daisy. With decades of experience, Daisy offers high-quality, affordable watercolor paintings suitable for hanging in your home, office, or even as a gift. With prices starting at just $55, visit tinyurl.com/artbydaisy to find out more. Hello and welcome to the Deathcast. I'm your host, author, and journalist Ian Tott, and I'd like to thank you for joining me as we prepare to take our fourth look at the crimes of Leonard Lake and Charles Ng. Before we get going, as always, I have the normal show notes. If you'd like to follow the show on social media, just search for the Deathcast, Deathcast Pod, or Deathcast Official. If you'd like to help support the show, there's a couple of ways that you can do this. You can go to buymeacoffee.com/thedeathcast and make a one-time donation. You can also go to your favorite podcast apps, follow the show, and leave a 5-star review. And lastly, you can go to tinyurl.com/dcastpatreon, where for as little as $1.99 a month, you can get access to early ad-free and exclusive shows, like my friends Channel and Anthony have done. Thank you guys, I honestly appreciate your support greatly. Alright, now that all of that's out of the way, find yourself a nice comfy chair, kick back, and relax. I've got my coffee, I've got my cigarettes. Let's go into the crypt! We left off last week. Charles Ng had just been released from prison and had made his way back to California to hook up with Leonard Lake, who by this point was living in Wileysville in his ex-wife's cabin, and he had begun construction of a bunker, which he saw not only as a means to survive what he perceived to be a coming nuclear holocaust, but also as a means to carry out his sexual fantasies, namely the taking and imprisoning of a woman to use as he saw fit. We also discussed in the last episode the murders that Lake has been tied to prior to the start of what is to come. This twisted fantasy that Lake dubbed Operation Miranda, which he took from a book called The Collector. As always, with this type of thing, I want to warn anyone who has a more of a sensitive nature that the stuff we're going to be getting into in this episode and subsequent episodes is extremely dark and disturbing, as Lake and Charles were not your typical serial killers. They were mission-oriented serial killers. They were also lust killers, and everything that they did was centered around this idea of keeping and using human captives as sex toys, for lack of a better term. Just prior to Ng getting to California, Lake is bouncing back and forth between Calaveras County and San Francisco, where he has rented another apartment with the stated idea of finding victims for this Operation Miranda. We know that Lake had a number of conquests during this time from personal ads that he has placed in local newspapers, On July 9th, Charles Ng arrives in San Francisco, where Cricket picks him up at the airport and then drives him over to the apartment that Lake has rented on 19th Avenue. And from this point on, it seems as though Lake starts working on Charles, talking to him about his ideology, his idea for this Operation Miranda. I say this as it's left to speculation in some part due to the fact that Leonard Lake stops recording his daily diary entries during this period of time when Charles Ng gets there. We know that he taught him how to drive during this period and also really laid out the foundation in Charles's mind of what Operation Miranda was and really started shaping Charles's mind. Now, that's not to take any of the blame away from Charles Ng. We discussed this in other episodes where you'll have an individual who's predisposed to being a serial killer. They may act on occasion by themselves until they meet that perfect partner with whom they can live out this fantasy life. And in Charles Ng, Leonard Lake finds this individual. And it's not long before the two men begin their criminal activity together. Before we dive into that, Lake stops recording in the diary for 60 days, and when he does resume it, of this missing time period, he said, quote, was to allow a period of time to pass that was best left unrecorded. On July 11th, a local disc jockey at a small radio station by the name of Donald Albert Giuletti received a response to an ad he had placed in an underground newspaper called The Spectator, looking for straight men that he could perform oral sex on. The recounting that we have comes from Giuletti's roommate, 31-year-old Richard Carrazza, who shared the upscale apartment with the DJ in the Castro District of San Francisco. A short Asian man with glasses comes to the apartment, and Carrazza leaves the two men to take care of business. After a few moments, Carrazza hears what he described as a series of loud popping noises, followed by a scream. Carrazza ends up hiding in a closet, praying that the visitor to their apartment is going to leave. And after a few moments, he comes back out into the living room to find his roommate lying on the floor in a pool of blood. And before he has time to process this, the front door opens, and this small Asian man, who was later identified as Charles Ng, shoots him once in the chest before fleeing the scene. The amazing thing about all of this is that Carrazza is able to call 911. And while Giuletti would not survive his injuries, Richard Carrazza does, and is in fact one of the only known victims to have survived Leonard Lake and Charles Ng. And it's important to note that these men were shot with a .22 caliber pistol. On July 25th, 1984, an Asian man showed up at the home of Harvey Dubs, a graphic design printer. Dubs had placed an ad in a local newspaper looking to sell some video equipment that he had, and at roughly 5:45 p.m. on the afternoon of July 25th, Dubs's wife, Deborah, was on the phone with her best friend, Karen Truck. Karen stated later that Deborah had told her on the phone about her day, how her father had shown up and taken Deborah and the couple's 16-month-old son, Sean, to Golden Gate Park, and that she was waiting at that point for someone to show up at the house and take a look at the equipment that her husband was selling. This is the last known conversation that anyone in the Dubs family had with anyone in the outside world. At some point after the termination of this phone call at 5:45, an elderly neighbor who lived directly across the street from the Dubs by the name of Doris Murphy saw an Asian man walking down the exterior stairs of the Dubs apartment. Later, she would state that the man was carrying with him a black oblong suitcase and appeared to be struggling under the weight. And here is where things really start to get interesting. This neighbor noticed that the Dubs family's vehicle, a Volkswagen Rabbit, had backed down the narrow street that they lived on and come up to the Dubs apartment. A man emerged who this neighbor later described as being robust with short, powerfully built arms from the driver's side of the vehicle, while the other man, who we know now was Charles Nung, struggled but succeeded in loading the suitcase into the trunk of the car before both men sped off. It's known that after this, Karen tried repeatedly to raise Deborah on the phone and was unable to. Now, these two women were extremely close. Some have described them as almost sisters, and the fact that she couldn't get Deborah on the phone alarmed Karen greatly, so much so that the following day, she asked her husband to stop by the Dubs apartment and see what was going on. And her husband is able to gain access to the apartment, and other than dishes inside of the sink, which to them was strange as Deborah Dubs was very fastidious about maintaining her apartment, he found nothing really out of place and ended up leaving, at which point he calls Deborah's father and learns that he has heard nothing from his daughter and son-in-law. And Karen's husband end up telling Deborah's father that the only thing he really found amiss other than the dishes was the fact that a set of keys was left dangling in the door. The neighbor across the street who had seen Charles Nung and Leonard Lake at the apartment later told investigators that on the day Karen's husband stopped by the apartment, she saw an unidentified vehicle driving away from the home. And these same two individuals were inside of this vehicle. While another neighbor who lived beneath the Dubs family reported hearing footsteps up above after the time when it is known the Dubs family had their last contact with the outside world. On Friday, this same neighbor heard footsteps upstairs in the apartment and assumed that either Deborah or her husband had returned. Now, she was in a rush to get to work during this period of time and ran out the door only to be confronted by Charles Nung coming down the steps from the Dubs apartment carrying a duffel bag and what's been described as a flight bag. This neighbor stated that she expected some form of a greeting from the man. However, he simply rushed by her, and when she attempted to call out to him, the man ignored her and continued on his way down the street. And she last saw him when a vehicle pulled up at the end of their block, and Charles Nung got inside of the vehicle, which promptly sped off. So why is this case different from the other ones that we know that Lake and Nung were involved in? Well, we have brazenness on the part of both men. They've obviously gone in and committed a crime against the Dubs family,
But here we have them over a span of multiple days, returning to the site to retrieve equipment and do God knows what else. Now that evening at roughly 11:30 p.m., this same neighbor returned with her husband from having dinner with friends when she saw what she thought was an individual moving around inside the Dubs' apartment. Going into their own home, this neighbor and her husband observed a burly man with a beard moving around through the Dubs' home and carrying what she later described as a large, dark, bulky item. Now, this neighbor believed at that time, and was in fact correct, that this individual whom she had seen was the same man she had seen driving Charles Nung from the scene of this crime. They report all of this to the police, as does Karen and her husband and the Dubs' relatives. And this neighbor, who is an artist of some description, actually draws a sketch for the police of both men that she had seen. And as it turns out, later on, once things come to a head, it's learned that these sketches bear a striking resemblance to Charles Nung and Leonard Lake. It should be pointed out that no trace of the Dubs family, what exactly happened to them, or their whereabouts of their bodies has ever been found, as Leonard Lake refuses to talk about this crime. Although I do have it on good authority that a friend of mine, a private investigator in California by the name of Laura Brand, is currently in talks with Charles Nung. Now, Laura is known to go out and befriend these serial killers, such as the Toolbox Murderers, Bittaker and Norris, in an effort to try and get information from them so that she can return it to law enforcement, you know, if there's any information cops don't have about, you know, crimes they may not know about, or locations of bodies that have never been found. So there is a hope that the Dubs family's remains might one day be found due to her efforts. Now, the only thing we have that really ties Lake and Nung to these crimes, other than eyewitness statements, is the fact that after the police get wind of what's going on, get involved, as we're going to talk about later, they find the Dubs' property at the cabin. Particularly, they find the audio-visual equipment that had been placed on sale through the classified ad. We know from Charles that during this period of time, the two men were ferrying back and forth between San Francisco and the cabin, getting things set up for Operation Miranda. We also know that at some point in August, Lake and Nung set their sights on an apartment complex in the Haight-Ashbury district known as the Pink Palace. It really was an apartment complex. It was more of a rooming house. They had 30 apartments, 10 on each floor, with shared bathrooms, that type of thing. It was low rent and was filled with individuals, many of whom had substance abuse problems, which is more likely than not the reason that Lake and Nung targeted this particular building. It's known that prior to the murders, Leonard Lake was known at the Pink Palace because of his dealings with selling drugs. Many residents knew of him under the name Alan Dre. Some found him to be a decent individual, while others saw him as strange. This was a young woman by the name of Maisha McLennan, who prior to these events, had been studying at San Francisco State University. She ends up getting addicted to drugs and eventually moves in with a man living at the Pink Palace by the name of Randy Jacobson. And the relationship turns sour. She sees that Jacobson, who's a Vietnam veteran, really has no desire or ambitions in life and decides to move out of the apartment but remain in this relationship and return to school at San Francisco State University. So she takes an apartment on 19th Street, which coincidentally is the same apartment building that Lake and Ning have a basement apartment in. Now, Lake, as Alan Dre, was described as a really strange dude, but kind of cool and kind of not cool. He likes growing pot, and he's a military-type person. Maisha later stated that when she met Lake, quote, "He didn't fit the description I'd heard. He was kind of heavy, and he had short, dark hair, and he wore a beret. He reminded me of my uncle." But Maisha very quickly began to grow suspicious of Leonard Lake and the Asian man, Charles Nung, who hung out with him. As she knew that Lake had moved out of his apartment, but still kept the apartment in the basement of the building, and was constantly there moving equipment in and out of it, while also selling drugs and looking for what he called models, as Lake let it be known that he was a professional photographer who'd had his work published in magazines, and he was constantly looking for women that he could photograph. Obviously, this is a ruse. He's simply looking for victims at this point. Again, this is all according to court testimony. Lake showed a very strong interest in Maisha. He eventually pressures her to model for her, which she eventually gives into, although according to Maisha, these pictures were not in any way, shape, or form scandalous. She described it as modeling, kind of fun, but kind of not, as she was really unsettled by Lake. At some point, Lake lets it be known that he's looking for an individual to take over his marijuana distribution in the Haight area. And the manager of the 19th Street Apartments suggests Randy Jacobson. And this apartment manager sets up a meeting between Lake, Jacobson, and Maisha, and this manager would later state that the reason he got all of them together at the same time was he wanted Lake to understand that Maisha was in a relationship and was therefore off limits. However, as we know, Leonard Lake is not an individual to be deterred, and despite the fact that he enters into a business venture with Randy Jacobson, and some felt that they became fairly close, he continues his harassment of Maisha, asking her to go out on dates with him, telling her that Jacobson is an absolute piece of shit with no ambitions and he's not good for her. Thankfully, though, Maisha refuses his advances. All of this leads Leonard Lake and Charles Nung into contact with various people throughout this Pink Palace complex, this subculture, if you will, inside of the subculture that is Haight Ashbury. And it's from this area that Lake and Ning, who have by this point completed construction of the bunker and the secret room within where they would keep their victims for use and abuse. It's known that Lake harassed numerous women during this period of time at the Pink Palace, pestering them to pose nude for him.
Many consented to what we're going to term innocent photographs, but refused to proceed further than that with him, at which point he would harass them. There are stories of some women finding that their apartments had been broken into and all of their possessions stolen after they refused Lake's advances. There are also stories of Lake offering various people, mostly women, sometimes couples, an opportunity to work at a pot farm he had in the upper part of the state. One individual who disappeared from the Pink Palace was an African-American man by the name of Maurice Rock. He was 37 years old and a guitarist. No one can really say why he disappeared, other than the fact that he was friends with a woman who would become a victim of Leonard Lake. Lake offered this man to come up and work at his pot farm, and he was never seen again. Now, this woman in question went by the name of Cheryl Okoro. Now, she had been born Cheryl Lynn Porter. It's known that she had at least one daughter who ended up in the foster care system. She had problems with various substances and had had a fairly troubled upbringing. Around the time that Maurice Rock went missing, Cheryl ends up going missing too, and we know that she was a victim of Lake and Nung because after everything comes to a head, an 11-page document that Cheryl had written, along with photographs of her, were discovered at the Wileysville cabin. Now, this next murder, I have to point out that various sources list different points in time when it may occur. Some state that it was in June, others that it was actually in October. In any event, Randy Jacobson, the man who was handling Lake's drug sales in the San Francisco area, he ends up getting an offer from Lake to possibly buy a broken down van that he and Misha own. Misha is ecstatic over this idea as they have very little money. She's going to school and this van has become a flop house for transients and homeless people and is getting a lot of parking tickets. So one morning, Lake shows up under the Alan Dre persona with the idea of purchasing this van. He ends up offering Misha a ride to school as well. He does so. Afterwards, when she gets to school, Misha calls the apartment, talks to Randy, let her know that she got there all right, and she never hears from him again. She states that after school that day, she went back to the apartment and waited for him to show up, and he never did. And after 3 days of this, she went out and canvassed the neighborhood. Some people are probably scratching their heads, wondering why she didn't go to the police or, you know, grow alarmed immediately. And the reality of the situation is, Randy was one of those individuals who was so carefree in his life and was dealing with such major problems due to his drug and alcohol addiction. He would simply vanish for long periods of time before showing up again without any real word of where he had been. There's also the fact that Misha got a letter in the mail, was really a scrap of paper with a message scrawled on it, purportedly from Randy, saying that he had gone to San Jose with an individual by the name of Steve, another pseudonym that Leonard Lake is known to have used, to work for a large drug dealer, and that he would be back to get his clothing in about a week. Obviously, this never happened, and it's really unknown why Leonard Lake ended up killing Randy Jacobson. except that he wanted the van that Jacobson had, which ended up being towed away before he could take possession of it. Later, Jacobson's remains would be found buried underneath the chicken coop at the Wileysville property. We can see at this point, though, the beginnings of a modus operandi or an MO from Lake and Nung. They are targeting individuals who have variously been described as drug addicts and street people in the Haight-Ashbury district of San Francisco. People who are not going to really be missed. Their disappearances, while noticed, are not going to seem strange. And people whose acquaintances, friends, and family are not going to call the police about them going missing. While all of this is going on, Lake and Ning are still living in San Francisco, with Ning bouncing back and forth between places to live and actually getting gainful employment to pay for the various things he needs in life. You know, the basic necessities, food, laundry, clothing, that type of thing. He eventually ends up getting a job at a moving company. And on the day that he starts, Leonard Lake returns Charles Gunner's van to Morgan Hill and leaves, going off in search of another vehicle. And it's interesting to note that this date is the date that Leonard Lake starts writing in his journal once again. And I'm going to quote here. "I have learned that my programming in my youth, that which is called morality, either was not given or was given poorly. To all purposes, save a very few, I have no morality. Accepted as fact, in terms of life or death, neither seems to move me. The past 2 months saw Miranda come to fruit. That taught me more. The perfect woman is one who is totally controlled, a woman who does exactly what she is told and nothing else. There are no sexual problems with a totally submissive woman. There are no frustration. There is only pleasure and contentment. I have observed, I believe, one woman who found this not only acceptable, but even desirable. I doubt this will be the norm, and in this case, the woman's low mentality probably affected the discovery. A whore, druggie, and fool. Still, I enjoyed using her, and seemingly she enjoyed the use. I do hope I do better next time, however. Pink Palace 1 and 2 help with money and sex. Fish was formally closed with the return of the van. I am now city-bound and living at my mother's." After this, Lake turns his attention to his money problems and also mentions that he has spent time with a number of women over the last few days, one of whom is Darlene Davies, whom he considers a perfect candidate for Operation Miranda. He ends this entry talking about a need to find a Pink Palace 3, but also of a need to reinforce the fencing around the chicken coop at the Wileysville property, as he does not want the German Shepherd to start digging around it and discover anything that may cause he and Ning problems. Lake continues writing in his diary, taking brief lapses whenever an individual goes missing. And some have postulated that Lake left these areas of time blank on purpose because he was still struggling to come to terms with what it was that he really is. I, however, am going to put forth the idea that more likely than not, Lake was not trying to leave anything which might incriminate him and possibly other co-conspirators in the crimes that he's committing. But more than that, he is really still fleshing out who and what he is. Now, during this period of time, while these crimes are going on, Lake is robbing individuals with the help of Charles Nung,
And he's also spending time with Cricket. And according to Lake, his time with Cricket comes to an end when, quote-unquote, her selfish ways drove him from her. Lake's diary entries describe wanting to find another pink palace, i.e. an area where he can cull victims from, but also a desire to find a vehicle, as well as his interactions with Charles Nung, who in his diary he describes as Charlie. How Charlie would meet up with him, give him various things that he had stolen, and that Lake would fence then for much-needed cash. On October 17th, Charles Nung ends up being arrested for shoplifting in Daly City, which is just outside of San Francisco, with Lake noting in his diary on October 7th, dealt with bail bondsman for Charlie, much hassle getting the money together and getting him out, and he, of course, shows no appreciation, problems, always more problems. Reality is that Cricket ends up putting up $1,000 for Charles Nung's release. Just after this is when Lake goes to get the van from Randy Jacobson's parking spot, only to discover that it has been towed away. And he also assumes Jacobson's identity on this date, changing his mailing address so that Lake can collect on Jacobson's Social Security disability checks. An entry on October 11th simply reads, coordinated with 3 and completed up. Pulled off with no hitch. It is routine now. Sweat, dirt, but no regrets. This is Lake describing the murder of Randy Jacobson. Part of the entry for Halloween reads, quote, spent day checking out potential ops, with one individual being located. Honda Prelude 80 with owner that could pass for me. On November 2nd, 1984, a 40-year-old man by the name of Paul Costner, who was a used car dealer, disappeared. Now, Costner had placed an ad for his 1980 Honda Prelude in one of the local newspapers. Obviously, Leonard Lake had taken sight of this. Now, prior to this, on Halloween night, Paul described meeting a really weird guy, had paid Paul a visit, driven the car, and said that he would return later. On November 1st, Lake wrote in his journal, meet Charlie tomorrow noon and make plan. On the evening of November 2nd, Paul's girlfriend speaks to him at roughly 7 p.m., later saying, quote, he was kind of rushed. He told me he had to get out and deliver the car he was selling. He didn't tell me who he was selling it to or where he was going. By the following morning, when Paul had not returned, obviously his girlfriend, who's living with him, becomes fairly certain that something is wrong, as this is not like her boyfriend. And so she calls Paul's sister, and eventually they contact the police. The police are of no help, basically telling them that, look, he's a full-grown adult. If you want to file a missing persons report, you need to do it after 24 hours have passed. And that's a problem within law enforcement that has, for the most part, been rectified, but not completely. In this country, if you're over 18 years of age, there are still police departments that will not take a missing persons report on you until a certain period of time has lapsed. During this period of time, 1984, most of the country was like this, and as a consequence of it, many people went missing, never to be seen again. So what Paul's family ends up doing is actually kind of ingenious, since the police would not listen to them about her missing brother. They contact the police and report his Honda as stolen. This quickly draws the attention of the police department, and they show up at Paul's home to take a report. His sister later stated, quote, they would take a report on something with a dollar value, but not one on my missing brother. Lake's entry in his journal on November 2nd states, "Met Charlie, performed op, met resistance for the first time, unsuccessful in obtaining credit cards or bank codes, drove to country for completion, canceled Charlie's running debt to me." Paul's sister would not let the matter of her brother's disappearance lie dormant, neither would his girlfriend, and the two of them ended up doing all sorts of things, contacting all the potential buyers for the vehicle that they could get numbers for, other individuals who had placed similar ads to inquire whether or not they had had any interactions with an individual that they would describe as weird, placing flyers throughout the Bay Area, as well as contacting and hiring a private investigator to look into his disappearance. They also refiled the missing person report with the San Francisco Police Department on a monthly basis, and it should be noted that law enforcement officials will tell you that if someone in your life goes missing or you suspect something has happened to them, when you're dealing with a police department that is uninterested in helping with the case, the best possible thing that you can do is to get as much publicity for the case as possible via local media, but also to stay on the police department to ensure that they are doing their jobs. As for Leonard Lake, he made a few more entries in his journal where he discussed his daily activities, work on the bunkers, getting supply for it, letters to Charlie, one entry where he states, "Final trip with the Honda until license problem is resolved." And then finally, on the night of November 9th, he makes his final known journal entry where he states in part, "And life goes on up here on alternate days as rained and I've done nothing. Numerous women are interested in meeting me. One is going to come up here. She may come up this weekend. If she does, I expect to screw her. Why else would a woman over 40 travel 100 miles to visit a man she doesn't know? She doesn't want to be screwed. Been playing with the video equipment, walking the dog, general stuff. As ever, reading a lot. Tonight, I retyped all my written journal notes, and here." It's known that Lake and Nung used Paul Cosner's car to travel around the Bay Area, visiting Lake's mother on Thanksgiving. At Charles's job at the moving company, his co-workers started noticing disturbing aspects to Charles Nung's personality. He was heard to say over and over to himself, "No gun, no fun, no thrill, no kill," as well as, "Daddy dies, mommy cries, baby fries." This is almost certainly a reference to the Dubs family. It's known that Charles had a number of arguments with some of his co-workers, including one individual by the name of Clifford Perantu, who was a 23-year-old man that had actually gotten Nung the job with the moving company. It's known at one point he stated, quote, "You goddamn Chinaman, I never should have gotten you this job." This is important because Clifford is going to end up going missing in January of 1985. Before we get to that, though, we need to get through December. A couple of interesting things come from this period in time. It's known that Charles Nung, going under the pseudonym Ken Kiyomoko, had gotten Leonard Lake a job remodeling a couple's bathroom, and on the first night after the job was completed for the day, he'd asked to leave his duffel bag there, and that the couple were curious as to what might be inside of it, so upon looking, they discovered negligee videotapes, a book on bondage, and other numerous items that they found to be odd. And the second day of the job, when it was over, Lake asked the man if he would consider driving him home to Wileysville, which is where Lake, by this point, was spending the majority of the time. The man
consented, and along the way learned that while Lake had a Honda Prelude, the tags had expired on it, which was the reason he wasn't driving it, and was also the reason why Lake had taken this job. Now, returning to his home, the man was disturbed to discover that some pictures of his wife had been removed from the house. He immediately began suspecting Charles Nung, and in fact reached out to Nung, who apologized profusely and promised to return the photographs, which was done the next day. That same week, it's known that Lake and Nung rented post office boxes in Pioneer, which is near Wileysville, under the names of Randy Jacobson and Michael Komodo. After this point, Lake is spending much more time up at the cabin in Wileysville, while Charles is still down in the Bay Area working at the moving company, earning an honest living as well as committing petty crimes. On January 18th of 1985, Charles Nung's co-worker, Cliff Perrantou, and a friend of his went out for drinks after work, with the two men making plans to meet up the next day in anticipation of the Super Bowl, which was to be played on that Sunday. Cliff ends up not showing up the next day, which really disturbs his friend, who reaches out and is unable to get into contact with him. The man goes so far as to drive over to Cliff's home and knock on the door. The man took note of the fact that Cliff's car, a blue Isuzu, was parked in its customary spot, but there was no sign of Cliff anywhere. And over the next few weeks, numerous people would take note of the fact that Cliff had gone missing, though it doesn't appear as though anyone had the foresight to go and contact the police regarding his disappearance. It's known that his friend at one point noted that the motorcycle which Cliff cherished was missing from the home, and that his ex-girlfriend had returned to the apartment after learning that he was missing, only to discover that numerous items were missing. She later said to police that there were oak-framed mirrors, candlesticks, a Buddha statue, and a little ceramic fish that all appeared to have been removed from the apartment. Now, at the end of January, a letter arrived at the moving company, which read, "Hey bro, I was hoping that Dennis would give you my address and you'd just mail along all my winnings. Since I haven't heard from you yet, I'm sending along an addressed envelope to save you the trouble of spelling my name. Hey, how about them Niners, huh?" And it was noted later by investigators that the name on the envelope, while matching, gave a return address of Post Office Box 349, Mokaluma Hill, California, and that had been sent from Wileysville on January 28th, 1985. The reason that this letter had been sent was because there had been a betting pool on the Super Bowl at the moving company and Cliff had won it. Obviously, Charles Nung, who's still working there, learned of this and decided to get his hands on it. The money was sent to this address. The owner of the company ends up receiving a letter as well, which reads, "Dennis, sorry to leave on such short notice, but a new job, place to live, and a honey came all at once. Please send my check for the last 3 days I worked at my W-2 to my new address." No one ever saw Cliff again. However, eventually, it would be learned that Leonard Lake sold Cliff's motorcycle to a man in West Point, California, and that numerous personal belongings of the man were found in the cabin in Wileysville. Towards the tail end of January 1985, a co-worker of Charles, known by the name of Jeffrey Gerald, 25 years old and a drummer in an aspiring band, had taken some time off from work. And apparently in this company, when you took time off from work, you lost your level of seniority, which makes no sense to me. But in any event,
When this man returned to work a week later, his boss informed him that he would not, in fact, be losing his seniority, and this apparently pissed Charles Ng off. To the point that on February 24th, 1985, Charles Ng placed numerous phone calls to Jeff's apartment. Now, it wasn't just Jeff who spoke with her, but also his roommate, who had heard Charles's voice on previous occasions when he had called to talk with Jeff. After talking with Charles, Jeff informed his roommate that he was going to meet Charles over at the bus station, and he lined up a private moving job which would earn the two men some money. Leaving the house, he stated to his roommate, "I'll be back by supper time and bring some Chinese food." It's also known that prior to leaving his apartment, Jeff contacted his childhood sweetheart, who by this point was living in New Jersey, and that they spoke for roughly an hour, mostly concerning plans for her to move to California so that they could resume their relationship. That evening, Jeff's roommate returned to their apartment to find that his bedroom door was ajar, the sheets from his bed were missing, and that numerous items of clothing were gone as well. This roommate also stated his guitar and amplifier, along with some pictures, had been removed, which was very strange. Jeffrey Gerald was never seen again. Now, some interesting things happened immediately following this. Leonard Lake, living up in Wileysville under the name of Charles Gunner, he'd been having some problems with a neighbor of his by the name of Lonnie Bond, who, along with his family, shared a driveway with Lake. The day following the disappearance of Jeffrey Gerald, a camp counselor from a nearby camp arrived at the Bond household to complain about the fact that they had been firing guns when camp was in session. Bond basically told the man to piss off, as it was his property, and that they were only firing into the ground. This man then went next door to Lake's home, and after knocking for a considerable period of time, Lake answered the door naked except for a towel which was wrapped around his waist. And the man noticed that this towel had a significant amount of blood on it. When questioned about the blood, Lake purportedly told the man that he had cut himself rather severely with a circular saw. We know from records that were obtained that after Jeffrey went missing, Leonard Lake appeared at a doctor's office in Jackson, which is roughly 18 miles from Wileysville, and that Lake had apparently shot himself in one of his fingers. Prior to going to the doctor, had attempted to get his sister to help him with this particular wound. This was on the previous evening at around 11 p.m. His sister, who had worked as a nurse, instructed her brother on how to clean it. The next day, Lake shows up at her house, asking her to clean the wound. And according to the story Lake told his sister, he had picked up a man who'd wanted to buy weed from him, and it had turned sour, with the man pulling a gun on Lake and the gun discharging into his hand. Afterwards, Lake goes to this physician, whom had encountered Lake before, and tells him that he was cleaning a gun when a .22 caliber pistol had discharged into his hand. After tending to this wound, Lake drove off, ignoring the doctor's advice to go see an orthopedic surgeon to ensure that no serious damage had occurred. And something interesting to note is that Lake had begun complaining to his friends and family that his new neighbor, Lonnie Bond, was really getting on his nerves. Bond and his family, as I mentioned previously, rented the property right next door to Leonard Lake's. Lake was upset that they constantly left the gate at the driveway open, but also that they were firing guns, which Lake stated could lead to somebody getting hurt. Which is interesting when you consider the fact that Leonard Lake himself was known to fire guns on his own property. He was also angry over the fact that Bond's wife had refused Lake's offers to photograph her. So there's a seething resentment growing there with Leonard Lake, and this type of behavior is something that he and Charles Ng share in common. Whenever they get a resentment against someone, that individual generally ends up going missing. And over the next few months, the problems between Lake and Bond are going to continue to grow, culminating in the disappearance and murder of the entire Bond family in April of 1985, which we'll be covering next week. At this point, though, I am going to end this week's episode. My Deathcasters and Deathcasterettes, I hope that you have enjoyed this episode, and I look forward to any feedback that you might have on it. Until next time, stay morbid!